I saved you all, and yet here you stand now, ungrateful, oblivious to all that I have done for you. Well, this curse is in the name of Belcur, who was ever so fond of spinning. When Aurora turns 16, she won't just hurt herself. She'll prick a finger on a beautiful, rare spindle, and she will die. The pronouncement lingered in the air for a few seconds, harsh as the snapped string of a viol, and then the Queen of Deluce let out a sob and clung to her husband's robes. Melfleur went on, directing her speech now at everyone in the room. Aurora's death will be a reminder to all who choose to ignore my wishes, to all those who have forgotten my greatness, forgotten what I have done for you, and the little I have asked in return. With that, she placed the pretty, silent baby back into her cradle and left. Bink swallowed. He did not like the taint of bad luck in this room. There would be no foreign wines uncasked now, he was sure of it. It took several moments of silence before Violet, who stood in a corner stroking her vibrant red hair in a long wave over her shoulder, finally put away the small hand mirror she kept close to her heart and approached the Queen, who was now weeping softly into her husband's shoulder.
As we all know, it is neither easy nor advisable to reverse a fairy curse, Violet drawled. Many dangers can befall those who attempt this challenge, but I am willing to give it a try, for the right price.
Please, please help us, the Queen said, dabbing at her eyes. The King took a step closer to Violet.
Tell us what you need, he said. We'll give you anything, anything you ask.
Violet licked her lips and looked around the room.
In exchange for amending Malfleur's curse, I ask for the light in your daughter's eyes. I ask for her sight.
Queen Amelie once again grasped the King's robes, shaking her head.
We've already allowed too much to be taken, she whispered.
We don't have any choice, the King muttered.
The Queen picked up the baby and held her to her chest.
I can't, she said. It's too much. We've gone too far.
Then she looked up, wild-eyed, at the crowd and her jaw opened slightly. Binks felt himself standing straighter.
Violet, the Queen went on slowly, we will give you the sight of the King's daughter.
Her voice was calculating.
But first, tell us how you will help us.
Violet smiled narrowly.
On her 16th birthday, the Princess Aurora will indeed prick her finger on a spindle. But, she held up a hand before the room could break into more murmuring, she will not die. Instead, she will enter a sleep so deep that only,
she paused, frowning evidently at a loss and trying to invent something convincing,
only true love may awaken her.
The Queen looked at King Henri with hope written on her face, even as Binks heard Almandine snort and caught Claudine rolling her eyes at the phrase, true love.
And now, for my price, Violet said, with a satisfied little purr.
The Queen handed the baby to the King. Standing tall, she shouted into the crowd,
where is Isabel? Bring forth Isabel!
The crowd parted, and a small child Binks had never seen before stumbled out, as though shoved, blinking nervously at all of the adults surrounding her. The girl had a mess of tangled dark curls and was wearing some sort of rag-like garment that only poorly resembled a dress. Binks couldn't help but wrinkle his nose.
What is this? Violet asked.
This, the King said, looking first at his wife and then at the fairy, is my other daughter. The Queen promised you the sight of the King's daughter, but,
he returned Violet's narrow smile,
she did not specify which.
10. Gilbert, former groom at the Royal Stables of Deluce, and Isabel's best friend of 18 years. Gil and Isby dismount from the spice merchant's cart in a fit of coughing.
Even after he is driven off, they cannot shake the heavy scent of pepper and cloves from their clothes. The merchant himself wore a thick cloth over his nose and mouth, though Gil wasn't sure whether it was to protect himself from sneezing all day or to hide his misshapen face, which reminded Gil of molten rock. Gil carries their luggage toward a cluster of trade ships bearing the yellow seal of Arben. Isby follows, her hand resting on his arm. Ever since they heard Binx's story, she has been worrying it over like a bit of wool in her hand until it has hardened into a plan. If you threw that plan over the pier, it would sink straight through the salt spray, past the icy layers of waves to the very bottom of the sea. It has weight to it, her plan. We've got to undo the sleeping sickness. The curse, according to its rules, Isby had explained after they left Binx's manor. We need to bring back Aurora's true love, the youngest prince of Arben.
Prince William.
It's got to be him, she insisted. They are engaged to be married. Her eyes went dark and solid, impenetrable as iron keyholes in the dead of winter, and he knew there would be no persuading her otherwise. Still, he tried.
Who's to say the prince is in love with a girl he has never laid eyes upon? Everyone knows their engagement is political and nothing else. Besides, it was his older brother who was supposed to marry her in the first place.
Isby's jaw got as hard as her eyes then.
Oh, he may not love her yet, but he will.
Gil, every single man who sees my sister loves her immediately. Most women too.
If that were true, then anyone at all might awaken her.
But it isn't.
I never fell in love with Aurora.
Isby huffed, causing stray curls to lift away from her face.
Are you saying she isn't beautiful and graceful? That she doesn't smell of wild raspberries late on the vine? And that her hair isn't the colour of the sun first thing in the morning? Or that the curves of her body aren't soft and perfect as the hills and valleys of Deleuze? Or that kindness doesn't radiate from her smile? She demanded, reciting a list of qualities she had heard repeated countless times by others. Gil half had the urge to laugh and half to pick up Isby by the waist and toss her into the nearest stack of hay. She was so stubborn and so oblivious to his true meaning.
Sure, I suppose Aurora's all of those things, he said with a sigh. That wasn't my point.
Isby folded her arms.
Well, in our case, it must be the prince who breaks the curse so that he can be credited for saving Deleuze, further solidifying their union. It's the only way we can show Malfleur that we are a stronghold against her magic. We'll show the fairies their curse means nothing to us.
He stared at her, studying the determination written on her face, which made it all the more stark and beautiful. Her lips were pursed just slightly, and he had to fight away the images that arose in him, images of touching those lips with his own.
You've really thought this through, haven't you? He said quietly. But since when are you so eager to save us all from the evil of Malfleur? I thought this was about your sister's health, and I didn't think you put any stock in those rumours.
Ever since the murder of the two elder princes, and now this mysterious fairy curse, I have thought of little else but the vulnerability of Deleuze. This isn't just about saving Aurora. This is about saving all of us. And let's face it, no one else is going to do it.
You don't know a single thing about Prince William, Gil said, feeling the familiar twins of frustration and awe creep into his voice.
In the easy way he knew he'd always win an arm wrestle with Isby despite her wiry strength, he also knew he'd never win a single argument. Still, he made one last attempt.
And what about Alice and Piers and Rule?
Isby sighed, and he could swear he saw softness shift across her face like a drifting cloud.
Rule will find a new wife to help him with the children. He never lacked admirers when he was young.
Neither of you did, she added. It should have been a compliment, but it felt like a dig. And he hated to admit why. Because it meant Isby saw him as more than a friend. She thought of him as a man, even a potential husband, for someone else. He wanted to tell her to let loose all the jumbled desires racing like fine chargers inside his chest, pounding their hooves in his veins. Sometimes he feared by holding it all in, he was creating some sort of inevitable stampede that would one day kill him. And yet, even as a bastard, even as a runaway, she was still a royal, the daughter of a king, and he would never be more in her esteem than a beloved groom, a childhood companion.
I don't like the idea of you travelling so far, Isby, was all he finally admitted. Especially not when times are so unpredictable. It's always been my job to keep you safe. You would have been trampled by a wayward mare, for you could hardly walk, if it wasn't for me.
Could she sense the purpose in his words? Isby placed both her hands on his shoulders, then let them wander up to his face as she had so many times over the years, reading his expression, altering it subtly with her touch as she did, so that he was left with the unsettling suspicion that she understood not what he was truly feeling, only what she wanted him to feel.
"I am certain this is the best core skill," she said at last. "There's only one thing of which I'm not fully certain yet." Already she'd begun to pack a small store of food and a change of clothes.
"And what's that?" he asked.
She stopped what she was doing and stood to face him again, her eyes landing just at his chin. He sucked in a breath. How he wished so often he could grab her in his arms and make her really understand him.
"Whether or not you'll be joining me," she said.
And so here they are, on the pier, about to board an oil vessel that will sail right through the strait, just under the noses of the sleeping castle village, and out across the North Sea, to Arben. Even now, the sails slap one another in the crisp winter air, as though applauding Isby's recklessness. Gil doesn't need to have his luck with him to know this is a bad gamble. But there is one thing of which he can be certain. He'll always gamble on Isby. He'll do anything, barter any sense he owns, to be near her, to remain a part of her, even though she may never know.
11. Aurora.
Time may have stopped, seconds or centuries may have ticked by while she remained held within the wall. But finally Aurora parts the stone, parts from it, though the coal still clings to her like a shadow. She begins to take in her surroundings, and an eerie sense of recognition floods her. But it must be a coincidence. It has to be. She's still shaken from moving through the wall illusion, and from seeing all the soldiers deformed, crushed, morphed into stone. Across a barren field, an old castle rises up from a tangle of dying vines and rotting tree trunks. Some sort of ivy, dotted with dried purple flowers, climbs from window to window, many of them boarded up. One entire tower has collapsed in on itself, and stone rubble litters the grounds. The day, if this even is the same day, has waned. Purple-pink light veins the dried grass, almost obscuring the long, narrow road that snakes to the mouth of the gate. In the distance beyond the estate, she can see that the road leads to the low, lopsided peaks of huts and even a church, though it's all blackened and in obvious disrepair, as if the whole village was razed by a bad fire.
"What is this place?"
she whispers. Heath smiles at her, all the wariness and urgency he exuded in the borderlands now gone from his face.
"Welcome to Blackthorn," he says. "Home of Queen Belcur."
Blackthorn. So she was right, in a way. She did recognize it. The Blackthorns used to hold a great spread of land in the rocky Lamort territories. It's where Queen Malfleur now rules. From there, it is said, the Fairy Queen can look out across the mountains to her entire kingdom, and can even see, if she squints, the gleaming cupolas of Deluce's palace, her childhood home in the distance. But Aurora and Heath aren't in the mountains, and this Blackthorn is inhabited not by Malfleur, but by her dead sister, who is not, Aurora reminds herself, dead at all, apparently. She can't help but wonder if she's tumbling through a dream. Then again, she has never dreamed with her lost senses.
"Do you live here?"
Aurora stares at the castle, distress creeping into her lungs.
"Most of us do. Our grandparents and their parents were Blackthorn's staff. But now we're more like tenants. We live here and we work here, but we don't really work for her. We don't even see her. She doesn't leave the north turret. For all we know, she subsists by eating the stray moths that find their way through her windows."
Aurora looks at Heath. She is having a difficult time separating her confusion about him with her overwhelming curiosity and wariness about this place. She clears her throat, picturing whittling her words into a knife, one that can cut through the fog.
I need to get home. My sister, and the prince, and...
Home, he repeats as though the idea were an uncanny one.
Toulouse. The palace, yes.
I'm afraid that may be a bit complicated, Heath replies. Come on, evening is approaching. You and I have much to discuss. Very much to discuss.
We do?
No one has ever had much to discuss with her, other than Isby. But he is already hurrying ahead at a half jog. Aurora follows, then abruptly stumbles, landing hard on her knees with a sharp cry. She has fallen countless times before, but this is different. It takes the breath out of her. Her legs feel wobbly, and one of her ankles throbs.
Aurora!
Heath runs to her side. She sees the object in the grass that tripped her, a glass jar lying in the dusty earth, which looks almost blue in the ebbing light. The jar is cool and firm in her hands, and full of dead fireflies. She lets it drop back to the ground as Heath helps her up.
Here, lean on me.
All of the lifting, the touching, the shuffling, hand to shoulder, arm to back, it's too much, but she has no choice. Her ankle is weak. It is singing a silent song of despair. She can't listen to it any more, but the pain won't go away. It's constant. She never knew what it really was to be hurt, even a little. She swallows and swallows again, trying not to cry, trying not to faint. Other people, she reminds herself, live with a sense of touch. They are not consumed by it. She breathes deeply and tries to distract herself.
What was that? She asked.
Part of the Queen's enchantment, he says. They're everywhere, these jars. If you tried to collect them all, you'd find still more would crop up, as though naturally occurring.
Enchantment. Another riddle. He seems full of them, like so many imprisoned insects. Isby used to collect fireflies, too, with Gil when they were kids. She'd bring them back for Aurora to light the secret passageway between their bedrooms. Aurora used to be disturbed by the way the bugs' bodies would glow as though aflame, and then go dormant, one by one, until she realized they were suffocating. She always wondered what it would be like to light up from the inside, like some beautiful cry of warning. They reach a broken wooden fence, then pass through a gate and down a dirt path. The last of the sun streaks the ruined castle in shadow as Heath raps a special knock on the door. Aurora holds her breath. They are entering the home of the Night Fairy. But it's a young boy, no more than 8 or 9 years old, who answers. He's dressed in a frayed tunic twice his size. He blinks out at them, his little face smudged with dirt.
Heath! He exclaims with a wide smile.
Heath ruffles the boy's head.
Flee. Be good and don't let anyone know we're here just yet, all right?
Too late!
The boy grins as what looks like the rest of his family appears in the doorway. A father, mother, and 2 older sisters, one carrying a baby boy in her arms, the other with a rounded belly suggesting her own child will come soon. All of them have a gaunt, skeletal appearance with deep circles beneath their eyes.
We were expecting you to bring home a deer,
the girl holding the baby says.
Your family?
Aurora asks him, feeling self-conscious in her now tattered cloak, which is still likely finer than anything these peasants have ever worn.
Not exactly, Heath says, then turns back to them. This is Aurora. She's... well, I'll explain later.
Aurora notices the wife and husband catch eyes.
Well, come in, of course, the wife says quickly. Dinner's almost ready.
Actually, Greta, Heath swipes loose hair out of his face. I'll have Rem bring Aurora's dish up to the tower later. I don't want everyone asking questions.
The sisters stare at him.
The tower?
The older one asks. The younger of the two has her mouth crunched quizzically to the left.
And what if we have questions?
Trust me, he answers easily. I've got more questions than you.
He pulls Aurora past them, through a large open hall in which a number of other peasants stop their chores to stare at her, then down a corridor into a kitchen full of rich scents, where he grabs a bottle of something from one of the side tables. Then he leads her into a back room lit by torches. He hangs up the rope he had been carrying on his back. He helps her down a series of walkways toward a flight of stairs. But it's all happening too fast, and his arm around her is both guiding her and making her dizzy at the same time.
Heath, I can't stay here, she manages. It feels good at least to say something firm, something definite. I have to get back to Deluce. They need me, she adds. The third prince will be waiting.
He turns to face her, placing a finger on her lips.
I need you.
She's too startled to reply or even to understand what he means. Her lips tingle, and she tries to rub them with her sleeve to make the sensation go away. At the top of the stairs is a tower bedroom that looks, to Aurora's surprise and relief, much like a parlour she might have seen in the home of a Delusian baron or chevalier, except that a layer of dust covers the once vivid red and purple brocades on the chairs and settees. A thick canopy hangs over the bed. One window has been thrown open to let in the spring-like air. The fireplace is unkempt, ashes piled high. This could be any number of rooms she's been in before, and yet it feels odd, like something is missing from the room, and the room itself knows it.
This should do, Heath says. You'll have privacy from the rest.
The rest?
We don't have many private quarters. Some people live five or six to a room here.
He helps her into one of the chairs.
Are you comfortable?
He almost seems nervous, even though just moments ago he'd been all grin and swagger.
Here, let me see your ankle, he says, pulling a stool up to her chair for her to place her foot on.
Then he kneels before her and gingerly removes her boot, lifting the edge of her dress to reveal her ankle. He takes a bottle from the kitchen, some sort of fragrant oil, and dabs a little on his hands to rub into her bare skin. She winces.
It doesn't look too bad. A minor twist, he says.
He begins to apply a poultice. Her teeth grit together, sending pressure along her jaw to the back of her skull. She's so tense she can hardly move. Finally, she lets out a small cry. He looks up at her in surprise.
I'm sorry, was I too rough? Are you all right? You look pale.
His hand goes to her cheek, and she reflexively jerks her head away.
Why are you afraid to let me touch you?
How can she explain?
Did I offend you in the cottage? I apologize for my rough behavior. I'm so used to defending myself, and it simply didn't occur to me at first that you could be real.
It's not that, she says, and then sighs,
trying to release the tension in her body, trying to breathe in the pain in her ankle and breathe it out. It is just a fact, no more, no less.
It's just that I've never felt like this before. I've never felt at all.
I don't understand.
And so she tells him, haughtingly, about her christening and the tithes the Fae took in exchange for their gifts. With each word, she feels a little bit braver, freer, more confident.
What kind of parents would allow that to happen to their child? Heath asks quietly when she finishes.
Oh, it wasn't anything malicious on their part, Aurora says. They believe the exchanges were worthwhile, or else they wouldn't have accepted them. They wanted to improve me.
By allowing your senses to be robbed from you. I suppose they thought beautiful and silent makes an ideal princess.
His words abrade her more harshly than his touch did. She opens her mouth to respond, but finds she can't. She doesn't know what to say. Because he's absolutely right, and the truth of it, hearing it spoken aloud like that, is stunning.
They wanted to protect me, she whispers at last.
That much he cannot deny. He clears his throat.
But not all touch is painful, Aurora.
Once again he reaches toward her cheek, and this time she tries not to cringe or move away as he traces his fingers ever so lightly along her jaw. It makes her want to cry, because he's wrong. All touch is painful. This kind of touch even more so. It makes her feel as though she is starving, lost, alone.
Aurora.
She'd been looking at the ground, avoiding his eyes. But now she focuses on him, takes in the warm tone of his skin, the light, messy shading of stubble along his jaw, the unkempt sweep of hair not much darker than her own. They catch eyes. He too has been staring at her.
Forgive me.
He clears his throat.
I shouldn't have done that, or said any of that. I just haven't ever met someone like you, someone from out there. I didn't... We weren't ever sure if it was possible.
Possible?
You see,
he says, gently finishing tying the bandage,
We've been imprisoned in Samai for generations. In the past, there were countless suicides, horrible infighting between those who believed in the real world and those who had already begun to forget it. Eventually, knowledge of the other world they had come from began to fade. Now my generation knows no other way of being but this. He gestures at the room around them. We've simply inherited this. This feeling of smallness, of being trapped.
Aurora swallows. She understands the feeling of walls closing in, of the world around her shrinking rather than expanding. Even when the council is focused on other things, which they usually are, she has always imagined their control over her like an invisible yoke. But it's not just the council members watching her, holding her back, keeping her in. It's the people of Deluce and their expectations of a crown princess, maybe even too the ghosts of her dead parents, wanting her to uphold their honor.
Many no longer believe the stories, Heath goes on, about the other world, your world. But I always have. When the Queen made Samai, she had to have created a way out.
The Queen made Samai, Heath nods. Aurora shifts, tempted to flee despite the continued ache in her ankle. His words have unsettled her. Part of her wonders if all conversations are this confusing, if she simply isn't used to talking normally with people, and that's why everything out of Heath's mouth sounds so strange. But then she thinks about what he's saying. Belle Kerr, the Night Fairy, made a world of her own, and now she rules here. Aurora runs through her 313 book collection of fairy histories in her head. She seems to remember something about the Night Fairy tithing.
Dreams, Heath says, just as she's thinking it. The Queen wove Samai out of dreams, or so the story goes. She has complete power here. She hides out in the North Turret, protected by enchantment after enchantment, while the world around us grows more desperate and more treacherous by the day. And for as long as any of us have been alive, no one has found a way to escape. And no one new has appeared. Until you. Don't you see? You're the proof. You're the answer.
But I don't have any answers.
You must, though. Maybe it will come to you. Maybe you'll remember.
Surely the Queen must know the way,
Aurora protests. He shakes his head. We've tried everything. She won't die and she won't answer our demands. She won't even come out of hiding. She's protected by too much magic.
Aurora believes him. It would probably take another fairy, a powerful one like Malfleur, to kill Belle Kerr or to break the spell, keeping them all in this world. I don't know how I can help, she says again, hating to disappoint him.
Just tell me what you know, he says quietly.
And so she does. She tells him all about Deluce, the political upheaval, the planned alliance, the murder of the two princes, the threat of Malfleur, who has, apparently, been lying for more than a century about the fate of her sister. She has always claimed to have killed her. But could it be she's took pity on her twin and simply banished her here instead? Wove a spell, trapping Belle Kerr in a world of her own making, perhaps? She wonders aloud. If that's the case, we'll never find a way out.
Go on, Heath prods. What happened after the murders?
She tells him about Isby, and how she fled into the night to find her, but discovered instead the abandoned summer cottage. Her chest expands with breath as she tells of the spinning wheel, golden and glimmering, as big as a forest beast, and how she woke up here in this place so unfamiliar to her. With every detail, she feels a warm honey glow rising up inside her until it seems her voice must be the brightest light in the room. All I can guess, Aurora finishes, is that the spindle must have been enchanted too. Belle Kerr was a weaver, correct?
Heath nods. It's all she does, even now.
Perhaps the spinning wheel belonged to her then, before she left my world for Samai.
But if what you're saying is true, Heath ponders, then why would Malfleur banish Belle Kerr here, only to leave a way into Samai?
Maybe Malfleur didn't banish her after all. Perhaps Belle Kerr... Aurora pauses.
Perhaps she came here of her own free will. Perhaps she is the one who left the way in.
Left a way in, but not a way out?
Aurora shrugs helplessly. There's nothing about this in any of her fairy histories. I already told you I don't have any answers. I'm more lost than you are.
He gets up and paces. I want to get you home, Aurora. And if we do, when we do, I'm coming with you. I've waited all my life for this. I will never be happy here in Samai. I've always known that.
I'll never stop thinking about what it's like out there.
I'm going to figure this out. And until then, I'll make sure you're safe here.
There's a rap on the door and a petite girl around Aurora's age pokes her head into the room.
Oh, good. Ren, come in, Heath says.
Ren enters with a tray of soup, a small hunk of meat and a rough piece of bread. The girl has delicate features, a turned-up nose, and small mouth. She's ghostly thin, her skin the color of tree bark when starlight hits it. Though her black hair is tied messily and her ears are overly pointy, she is very pretty.
I know I can trust you to be sure Aurora is comfortable, he says.
Of course, Ren replies, her voice soft and lulling. Her thin lips pull down to one side. Any friend of Heath's is a friend of mine, she says to Aurora. Heath leaves the room and Aurora can almost feel the chill in his wake. You're cold, Ren says, setting down the tray. She goes to the hearth and looks for the flint box. Thank you, Aurora notices her fingers fumble. Are you all right? She asks the girl. Yes, but I wish, Ren whispers. Forgive me for saying. I wish you wouldn't encourage him too much. Heath? Ren turns to face Aurora, her eyes big and dark. No one can be happy if they're always searching. That's what I think anyway. If you believe you're living in a shadow, you will never feel the light. Do you see what I mean? Aurora tests her ankle and stands up, wincing only a little. Miss, sit back down. Ren comes toward her. No, no, I'm fine. Aurora waves her off lightly. Let me help you. I want to help. She approaches her, and even though Aurora has only ever lit a fire a few times, she takes the flint box from Ren's trembling hands. After a couple of tries, she manages to catch a spark and kneels down to place the lit tinder into the fire. However, something in the fireplace catches her eye. A glimmer. She gasps. Ren, are these jewels in the ashes? She whispers, nearly dropping the tinder. She scoops up the gleaming stones, a necklace made of pearls separated by tiny rubies. Why would someone leave these in the fireplace? I'm sorry, miss. The room hasn't been cleaned. We don't usually put guests here. We don't usually have guests at all. Inspiration flies into her. You could trade these. Sell them. You could buy food for everyone in Blackthorn. Ren sighs, kneeling beside her. She takes the lit tinder and lights a log. There is no food to be bought, she replies softly. We rely on the hunters, like Heath, to bring back meat. We ration the grain, which struggles more to thrive every year that goes by. She helps Aurora back to her feet, and both of them step back from the growing flames. Ren's light hand on her elbow sends a message through Aurora that overwhelms her with its tenderness. She looks down at the beautiful stones coated in a light layer of ash, which have left black dust in her palm. But still, she starts, and trails off. Aurora would gladly hammer out all of the emeralds and sapphires in her crown to help the people of Samai, if she had it here. But perhaps Ren is right that the jewels would do no good. It has never occurred to Aurora to feel embarrassed by who she is, or worse, ashamed. She's lived a life of tasseled pillows and billowing gowns, while these people suffer. She traces her fingers over the string of pearls, then slips it into the pocket of her gown as a reminder. I'm sorry, Aurora says now. I want to help you, and Heath, all of you. I wish I knew what to do. Her voice has begun to come to her with ease, but the answers have not. Ren looks at her curiously. Samai must seem a sad place to you. But it isn't. Not entirely. The evils here are no worse than the evils anywhere, I imagine. Why should I want to learn of another world? A vaster world, if it means regretting my whole life until now. Who wants to be made to loathe what they have? Small as it is, my life is mine. But there's so much you're missing. There's a great wide expanse of a world to explore where I'm from, she protests, her heart swelling with love for Deluce. Though even as she says this, a dull voice thuds through her veins. Has she ever thought to explore her own world? Just promise me you won't give Heath false hope, Wren says, taking Aurora's hands in her own. And Aurora has the wild desire to tap into her small palms. You'll only break his heart. A moment later, Wren lets go and moves back to the silver tray, where she lifts a lid off the soup dish. I'll let you eat and rest now. Aurora tries to taste her food, but all she can think of is the look on Wren's face. If she ever gets home again, she is going to appreciate her world. She's going to tell Isby every day how much she cares. She's never going to be ensnared by her own fears again. But for now, she's not home. She's here. Sir May. She rolls the word around in her mind as she takes off her travel clothes to change into the nightgown Wren left out for her. It's the first time she's ever had to dress or undress herself, but she can't stand the idea of someone else doing it for her. Not now. Not when a mere breath against her skin sends her into shivers so intense she's not sure if they're pleasurable or sickening. Even now, as she steps into the lightweight gown, every thread whispers around her and against her. She climbs into the bed, settling into its deep embrace. She's exhausted, but her heart burns with curiosity. Deluce needs her. Isby needs her. The last fairy queen in her world could be marching at any moment, could even now be committing more unthinkable murders. And yet, what will happen if... No, when Aurora returns? Will her voice and sense of touch immediately snuff out like a candle? She doesn't know why these senses have returned to her, can only imagine that the fairy tides at her christening somehow don't hold weight here in Samai, that Bel Kerr's magic, evil as it may be, nullifies any other. This is a world of Bel Kerr's making, after all. And what did Wren mean when she said Samai was full of beauty? The worn softness of a pillow caresses her cheek. She is penetratingly aware of every single stitch in its fabric, a grammar of its own, a way of being she never knew before coming here. She thinks of all the everyday objects that she's never fully known. She would like to meet them all with her hands, to feel the secret code of their physical forms, the silk, the paper, the wood, the string. Marble and grass and fallen leaves and a baby's hair and the ears of a goat. They are all as utterly foreign to her as the unusual bird-like clock she saw in the nursery room in the cottage, and the enormous golden spinning wheel that pricked her finger and gave her the curse or gift of pain. The ghost of Heath's fingers sighs along her jaw. Will it haunt her forever when she leaves this place? She has only just learned this form of closeness, and already... she fears how much she craves it, craves more, how devastated she would be never to have it again. She extends her hand to the bedframe, touching its old, polished oak. She presses her fingers against it as though it were Isby's palm. I'm afraid, she taps, wishing her sister could hear her. She thinks of the words Heath said to her earlier that startled her so. I need you, she taps. 12. Isabel. Evening wind whips at her neck. Isby inhales, clenching her eyes against the freezing ocean spray. There are rumors among the sailors that the waves have been angrier than usual this winter, ever since the purported death of someone they refer to reverentially as the Balladeer, a figure much spoken of but rarely seen. The Balladeer is said to have roamed the North Sea for many years, singing to the water in the water's own language, using music to draw fish straight into his wide nets. Some believe he was one of the Fae, but others say that cannot be, for the Fae are driven only by greed. Very poor seaside villages in the north had, over the past 10 years or more,
reported enormous bundles of fresh-caught herring and eel, cod and pike, and sometimes even oysters appearing on their shores as though left there by some benevolent god, and they swore they could still hear the final notes of the balladeer's song in the air as they collected these unexpected gifts. But, whether god or fairy or human, the balladeer is gone now, and the waters, turbulent and brutally cold, seem to know it. Clinging to the rail of the rocking ship with one hand, Isby dips the other into her pocket, feeling for the lock of hair there, coarse and curly. Gil was horrified when she demanded he hack away the long tangles that had been blowing in her face for nearly 18 years. At first he'd refused to help, but when she determined to do it for herself, he conceded, not wanting to stand by and watch her wield a rusted old fish knife so close to her own skin. She brushes her fingers against the reminder of what they've done. It was necessary, along with binding her chest and donning the garb of a young sailor. Before boarding the ship, she and Gil were both questioned.
No one wants to carry the sleeping sickness abroad with them.
But using the last of the coins Isby had taken from the palace before she left, they managed to convince the captain to change his mind about allowing Gil and his blind brother aboard the ship. The echo of lifeboats rattling along the ship's sides greeted them as they boarded. She was surprised by how many deckhands there were, and unsettled by the fishy oil-lantern stench mixed with manly sweat. Now, as she turns to make her way below decks, the odor increases. She has spent most of the day trying to stay out of the way of the experienced hands, listening to the thunk of oil barrels in the cargo hold and the thickly accented calls of the sailors in a language she barely recognizes as her own. Avast and abaft, dead rise and draft. Wishing she could participate, but knowing how dangerous it would be to get in the way of a swinging beam or changing sail. And the last thing she needs is to draw unwanted attention. She must not jeopardize her goal of reaching William of Arbyn safely. At her request, Gil described the various spears and daggers strapped to the wall, the volgers she'd heard of. They resemble a meat cleaver but with a longer handle. And the Ranser, too, trident-like with short sides. At the helm sits one foreign weapon that neither Gil nor Isby recognize, a giant spear that springs forward like an arrow, but with a long rope attached to the end. She can tell from the quiet now that the decks are mostly cleared, save a few sailors who will man the ship through the darkest hours. Though she dreads another night in the crowded, low-ceilinged cabin below, the air thick with grunts and snores and the scurrying of rats, she knows that, come sunrise, they'll be within rowing distance of Arbyn's shores. Unused to the violence of the waves, she fumbles for ropes and beams to guide her, 10 paces to the hatch, 7 rungs down the ladder. Below decks, no one can stand to his full height, and certainly not Isby, who is as tall as many of the men and feels a bruise forming on her forehead to prove it. She ducks, using her hands to trace the rough-hewn sides of the narrow bunks until another hand wraps around hers, silently indicating for her to stop. It's Gilbert already lying in his bunk. Even out at sea, he still smells faintly of leather and fresh hay. She climbs onto the hard bunk below his. Though she'd hate to admit it, there's no way she could make this journey alone. She can't even find her own bed without help. Her bones hurt, her head feels heavy, her body tight and cramped. She longs for an open field to ride through, for the earth's quantity of steadiness, and for peace of mind. Every night Isby has been turning over her plan and the many ways it might go wrong. Getting into the palace shouldn't be hard. Traders and messengers are constantly coming and going, and Isby knows her way around a palace. But what if she'd stopped before gaining conference with the prince himself? Or what if he rejects her plea? What if he agrees to help, but it's already too late? Gil was right. This is a foolish, wild mission. The vessel creaks and groans. Waves beat against it. Sleep undulates around her. A dark water. Arms are rocking her. A voice sings. One night so mild, before break of morn. The words are in her blood, thrumming in her ears. Except part of her remains awake. aware that the words to the famous lullaby about Belcur and Malfleur usually say reviled, not so mild. Still, the song goes on, swirling around her, amid the roses wild, all tangled in thorns. The shadow and the child together were born.
She is cradled, she is small, she is warm, helpless held.
But then a voice, soft and not quite recognizable, changes key. The girl and her twin, their sisters did play, till darkness did win the light from the day. Isby tosses in her sleep. That isn't the version of the lullaby she knows, the version everyone knows. The meaning of the new words swim inside her, confusing her. It's not entirely different, but the phrases have been rearranged and altered in her dream. Play. The two girls are playing. That's not part of the original song. How does it usually end? One her dear twin forever did slay. Tears fall on her skin. She is rocked, cradled, dreaming, but not dreaming. Something in the voice. Who is singing? Mama, Isby wants to cry out. But she cannot speak, and the desire rips through her chest, a stabbing pain. Isabel, the voice sighs. My sweet Isabel, my sweet.
Leopold! Leopold! Isby!
Gil is hovering over her as she wakes. She can feel his breath on her cheek. He is shaking her, addressing her with the fake boy's name they decided on. The world around her convulses. Even in the roiling cabin, she can smell that it is still night. She can only have been asleep an hour or two, but the sailors are rustling and shouting and moving about, clambering up the ladder. Is it a storm? She sits up, banging her head against the upper bunk. What's happening? I don't know. Come on, Gil says, pulling her up. They stumble toward the ladder. Isby's whole body is shaking with excitement, and something else, too, the memory of that dream, that voice. She hasn't had a mother dream in years, but she used to have them a lot. They always leave her feeling light-headed and hot. She never before realized how strange it was that there are two separate versions of the Rose Lullaby, the one everybody knows and the one she just heard in her dream. Her mother, whoever she was, must have sung her own version to Isby as a baby. Maybe she simply didn't like the gruesome nature of the original. A sound of clattering rings out above, as though the 20 men have tripled. Her hands grip the rungs. She hears the captain hollering to the rest.
A pod! The whole host of them! And Nars too!
Gil turns and shouts down at her, his voice crackling like a lit match.
Narwhals!
Above deck, all is chaos, and Isby gets instantly turned around. She is shuffled this way and that. She falls to her knees. The vessel rears up like a giant, startled horse. Men are screaming directions at one another. The rack of weapons clangs loudly as they grab for spears. She thinks of the foreign weapon rigged to the helm, and its name and purpose emerge out of all those days spent learning from Aurora. Not just about fascinating devices used for warfare, but also those used for hunting. This one could slay enormous sea creatures from 5 feet long to 30. A harpoon. She scrambles to her feet, feeling like such a fool for not realizing sooner. All these men and all these weapons. This isn't just a merchant vessel bearing oil from one shore to another. It's an active whaling ship. And now they've discovered a pod of narwhals, which are among the most treasured creatures of the sea because of their long, unicorn-like tusks. Isby remembers Aurora telling her the famous White Throne, on which the North Fairy was murdered years ago, was carved and constructed solely from their ivory.
Isby,
she hears, and Gilbert grabs her arm again.
What is that sound?
She shouts, trying to understand why it's as though 60 men, and not 20, are pounding across the deck.
Drums.
Isby pauses, understanding.
To lure the animal.
Through the noise, she can hear the captain shouting,
All hands!
A thrill flies through her, and she hardly feels the cold wind lashing her. She used to think adventure was sneaking out her window to play in the fields with Gil, or stealing strips of meat from the kitchens to try and lure the sharp-toothed foxes in the royal forest. But for the first time since leaving the palace, it strikes her how far she has come. With the roar of the sea in her ears and the violent sway of the boat beneath her, she realizes that the very notion of adventure is a lie, for it predicts an arc that ends in its hero triumphing over challenge. This is no adventure. This is life, pure and raw, and she can feel the difference, can taste it, its elation and its terror, but most of all, its wild uncertainty.
His, Gil whispers close to her ear. Her hands find his.
She feels the strength of his arms and shoulders as he tries to steady them both, to steer her back toward the shelter of the hatch. The boat sways and they stumble together. Her back hits a low wall. He pulls her down to the floor again, leaning over her, protecting her from the spray and the wind and the sailors pushing past them. He puts a rope in her hands.
Stay here. Hold this. Wait for me.
But his hands are on her shoulders, on her chin, cupping her face.
Wait here.
The whisper is so quiet and yet so clear, it is like a cloak finding its hook. She pulls him closer. They cling to each other and she finds his ear.
Gil, what are you?
But his head turns before she can finish, and his mouth brushes her jaw. Instinct, as unplanned as a breath, guides her lips to his. His cheeks and jaw are slick with ocean spray. Salt stings her tongue. The kiss is hungry and hard and over before she can understand it. She grasps for him, but he slips out of her hands. Another sailor is there, trying to move past them, shoving them forward and apart.
Quick-like,
he barks, and Isby finds herself banging her elbows and legs as she's thrown to the side and then down into a wooden basin, which is being rapidly lowered. It's one of the dinghies at the side of the ship, she realizes quickly. And there are several other men on board who are passing around weapons and oars.
Kill! Gilbert!
She cries out, flailing her arms. But she has lost him, and it feels like she has lost herself. The tiny lifeboat tosses in the rough waves, and she falls again and again. Metal slashes the air just beside her face. Salt water stings and burns like ice. She kneels and clutches at the air, but can't get steady. She can't think. Between the howling of the sea and the shouts of the sailors and the thrumming of blood in her ears and the conviction that she is going to die out here in the water's vast, roiling, unknowable passion. Her spear is thrust into her open, shaking palms. Most of the crew know she is blind. Why would one of them give her a weapon? How could they not realize? But it is night and dark, and sighted men do not do well where they cannot clearly see. More barked orders, formations and directions in the words she doesn't comprehend. Something about smallest men to the bow. She is shoved to the front of the tiny craft. Fear clenches down inside her, becomes an iron nail hammered tight to her heart. As she grips the rusted handle of the spear in one hand and hangs on to the side of the dinghy with the other, she at last grasps what's happening. She is part of the hunt. The drums are beating. The sailors shout their commands.
Lean into it, lad,
a man commands from just behind her. He's talking to her, but she doesn't have an oar, doesn't understand the command. Does he mean lean into the motion of the boat? Perhaps it's like riding a horse, where one must allow one's body to move with and not counter to it. Though she cannot see, there are things Isby knows. She knows, for instance, that the man who just gave her orders has a thick beard. Even amid all this madness, she can smell how it traps the rancid odor of his last several meals. She knows his muscles are likely bulging from the effort of rowing the dinghy. She can tell this from the arrhythmic thrashing of wood against wave, the pauses, the creaks, the panting of effort, the warble of worry in all the men's voices. And she knows something else, too. Knows it deep in her bones like an echo in a long corridor. The beast is nigh. Nearly as soon as she experiences the buzz of that thought, the dinghy lurches, the bow flying upward into the crashing waves. She's thrown onto her back and swallows a huge gulp of seawater. Sputtering, she tries to sit up again, conscious that the spear is still in her hand, and that she could have stabbed herself or someone else with it.
Kill!
She cries again fruitlessly. Her ankle throbs. It's twisted at an unnatural angle.
"Encircle!"
she hears. The command has come from a different boat. They are surrounding one of the whales. She tries to picture the giant narwhal, with its long, majestic, glimmering horn. Tiny boats on all sides getting closer. Men poised with their weapons. The great fish diving and surfacing, trying to get away. Faster, she thinks. Hurry! Escape! Of course, she knows where and how Deluse gets its oil from the fat of these animals, and Isby has witnessed many a hunt during her lifetime. Yet somehow, this is different. She is flooded with awe, wonder, and repulsion. Then she hears it, the zing of the harpoon's spear flying through the air, followed by a noise Isby can only describe as murderous. The creature has been hit. It's as though the whale's cry contains the varied cries of whole families, of past and future beings, a strange and tragic symphony of mangled horns and snapped strings. And then the world goes mute. Even the sea waits, eerily still. Now a high, song-like wail breaks the silence. There's a loud, angry splash. All the men begin shouting over one another again, and she hears weapons rapidly drawn.
Round boat, Adeline! She's diving! Sophia! Sophia! Loosen line! All hands! Atch the bow! We're losing her!
It's the captain's voice. He's calling directions to the smaller boats, each of them given female names. Maria, Sophia, Adeline, Clementine, Clarabel. Then a frenzy of spattering and screaming as they try to stab the beast, many losing their spears if not their footing. A few have gone overboard from the sound of it. She doubts they'll be saved. Her breath clatters in her chest. Is Gilbert among them? She tastes rust and blood in the salty air.
The rope! Clarabel!
The captain shouts.
Close now! That's you, lad!
Isby is shoved hard in the shoulder. She tries to breathe, but her lungs burn. The spear is slippery in her hand. The hunt has somehow unthinkably come down to her. The whale leaps and her boat is jerked forward. It feels as though her heart has leapt up too, to clog her throat. Their oars are tangled in the harpoon's line. She chokes on salt water. At any moment, they'll all be tossed into the sea and likely battered to death by the giant writhing fish. The rope winds as it's pulled tauter and tauter. The whale is yanking hard. It will drag them down with it into the depths of the sea. She realizes, with terror, what she must do if she wants to live. The boat tilts and heaves again, and she's nearly thrown over, but someone grabs and steadies her.
Now, now! We cannot hold her much longer!
She doesn't know who made the command. The words surround her, coming from the wind itself. Now! Now! The waves roar, the whale bellows, the rope hisses. She only has one spear, one thrust, one chance to get this right. It's impossible. She clenches her eyes, listening hard, leaning into the movement of the dinghy, even as she tries to feel for the movement of the agonized creature beside and below and before them. Now, now, now. The waves lash, the whale moans. The rope sings. Her heart stops. The spear flies. 13. Claudine, a fairy of considerable stature, in more ways than one. Claudine would not have believed the rumors had it not been for a lack of jam. She finds herself this morning quite short of the sweet preserves that normally provide her only pleasure in waking up. Her maid trembles at her bedside, holding out a wobbling silver tray with a large hunk of rye bread on it, bare as a baby's head. Claudine backhands the tray, which flies from her maid's grip and clatters to the floor.
"So it really is true, then,"
she mutters, adjusting herself against her giant stack of pillows, her body, a mountain underneath the thick burgundy quilt, heaves with the effort. She's heard the story by now. News travels fast in winter, when there's nothing else to do but gossip. Princess Aurora of Deluse was found motionless on the upper floor of an abandoned summer cottage, lying next to an enormous golden spindle. A maiden's scream drew others to the sight. The princess, presumed dead at first, was in fact sleeping far too deeply to awaken. The maiden, who discovered her, promptly fell into a